If you want to see some of the people and places we're talking about in the show, visit our website, downthehillpodcast.com.
What did you see when you got out here that day?
Well, there was a lot happening at that time. You know, there was still a huge, huge response from this local community, which, by the way, is just really is an extraordinary place. There was a flurry of law enforcement activity from agencies all over, as people would expect, and as we've come to expect internally. And I could just see the complexity on people's faces and on their, in their comments and the way they looked and the way they acted and the way they walked. And because it rocked this community. And remember, it was on the heels of the Flora fire that killed those four little girls in Flora, in the same county, in the same rural county in middle of America, you know? So
it's a lot of tragedy.
A lot of tragedy, a lot of sadness, a lot of hurt, pain, and sorrow. And I knew we were going to have a heavy burden. I just knew we were going to have a heavy burden. Part of that was because of what the expectations would be. Coordinating an event, an investigation of this that's this complex. I had a lot spinning around in my mind, personally, in my mind. But as I looked around and I saw what was happening, I knew that we were up for the task.
There's a difference between up for the task and ready for the task. 24 hours after Abigail Williams and Liberty German went missing, what Doug Carter and his officers were about to see and learn, well, years later, it still keeps them up at night. Near the waters of Deer Creek in Delphi, less than a quarter mile from the bridge, Libby's sister Kelsey hears searchers discover a black Nike shoe, the same kind Libby had been wearing the day before. Seconds later, in a ravine filled with leaves, volunteers in the search party find two bodies.
Police are also examining this Snapchat photo. It was taken just before both girls disappeared.
I made the announcement that the girls had been found and it was not to a good end.
We are investigating this as a crime scene. We suspect foul play.
Law enforcement is saying that one of the girls actually took video on her iPhone. They say it was right before she was murdered.
It's amazing that we have a video, we have a still photograph, we have sound, and we don't know who this person is.
It could be half of the white males in Carroll County.
To the killer who may be in this room. We likely have interviewed you. We know that this is about power to you, and you want to know what we know. And one day, you will.
This is Down the Hill, the Delphi Murders.
I'm Andrew Iden.
And I'm Barbara McDonald.
And we're here in the writer's room at CNN Center. And Barb, as we look at this case and kind of where we are in the timeline, here's what we know. Two girls, Abigail Williams and Liberty German, 13 and 14, have been murdered. We know that these girls went missing late in the afternoon. And we also know that their bodies were found just a short distance from that bridge on some private property. And at this point, there's a lot of action at the crime scene. It's a little bit chaotic. There's state police, local police, sheriff's department, fire department. So it's getting a little chaotic, as you might imagine.
And it's a gruesome scene. Many of those officers told us that it's something they're not going to be able to unsee. And this is where the questions are beginning. Where were these girls killed? How were they killed? And why? Why did this even happen? We've spent months looking into this. We've made several trips to Delphi. We have talked to dozens of people. And we're not trying to solve this case. What we're trying to do is really understand it. And to understand, can this be solved? What actually happened out there in those woods that day? And who did it?
And yeah, it's important to note that point about not trying to solve this, because there's a lot of complexities here. You know, we've talked about a lot of things that over the course of the story, as it unravels, some things are clear, some things aren't. Some things that are blurry then become clear. The things that are clear then become blurry again. There's a lot of moving parts. So, Barb, it's important to note that at this point in our story, this is when everything changes. You have a community that has been traumatized. You have families that are traumatized. And at the same time, you have multiple law enforcement agencies that are beginning a double murder investigation in earnest.
And the other thing changing is Valentine's Day. It's February 14th. That'll never be the same.
And so as we're trying to make sense of this story, this is when that starts for everybody else in Delphi, too.
Part one. We didn't win this one.
I'm trying to think of what the word is. Because it's not exasperation. It's not confusion. I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's a shock. And that's probably the best way to describe it. It's something that was unexpected. You knew it was a possibility that the girls would be out there. Dead.
So, Barb, we've talked about a lot of the things involved in this case and the factors that make it stand out, unlike others. And one of the things that really makes this thing different from others is that there are family members that are virtually at the crime scene when the girls are found.
In organized search parties, out there looking for Abby and Libby when there's a discovery. And as we pick up our story, Becky and Kelsey are both out at the crime scene in those organized search parties. We have other family members at the command center. Fire Chief Daryl Sterrett is at the firehouse that has become this command center, and he's taking care of his fire crews who are out at the scene.
And this is like a 40-minute window of time where for a lot of these family members, not only is it the worst possible news they're ever going to hear, but I would imagine a lot of them look at their lives before this 40 minutes and after this 40 minutes.
Changed everything.
So that starts with Libby's sister, Kelsey, who had just learned they'd been discovered.
At that moment, I wanted to run across the creek and get to them. I was like, they're alive. I know they are. They have to be. Until somebody said something else, and I knew that they weren't. In that moment, I was with another lady who had actually lost her brother in high school, and she just hugged me until I calmed down.
Kelsey's grandmother, Becky Patty, is also searching along the trails, and Kelsey's grandfather, Mike Patty, is at the fire station, and here's the call come in from searchers.
It said they may have found the girls, you know, out near the high bridge. And so I just went and jumped in my truck and drove straight out there. And that's when I come up on Becky, and most of my family was already there. And it wasn't good. It wasn't a good, you know, we all knew at that point that they'd been found. But, you know, because again, we had some friends that actually were in a search party that found them, and I talked to him a little bit, and you know, they've been found. It's almost like disbelief, you know, you don't want to believe this. I remember getting Becky and saying, okay, let's, you know, it's no good for us here. I remember leaving and remember stopping and seeing friends of mine who were in search parties just lined up along the road. And then when I talked to the buddy of mine who was in the search party, found him, I something horrible had happened. I knew that. Let's put it that way.
At the same time, Tobe Lesenby, sheriff of Carroll County, gets the news.
So when you heard they were found, how did your mind process that? What did you think must have happened?
Well, you're right. I mean, being that close to a stream that can be unpredictable sometimes, you know, and not having those initial answers, you know, we're thinking, okay, did they drown? You know, where specifically were they found? You know, all those types of questions that hadn't been answered at that point. You know, and of course, being in law enforcement, we had to, at least in our own minds, have that thought run through our minds that, okay, were they, you know, was there criminal activity afoot here? So, yeah, there were just a large amount of various unanswered questions at that stage.
And when did you find out that this looks like foul play?
It wasn't long after that initial call, actually. I'm going to say within, as I recall, within the hour of getting the initial one. And just put a whole different twist on the whole scenario for us at that stage.
And what does that do to these men gathered at the firehouse? You said that with that first call, you could hear a pin drop as it becomes known that this is looking like a crime. Is it still quiet?
As I recall, yes. I think that, for, again, that first hour to allow it to set in, I think that first hour, yes, there was, for me, it was disbelief. But eventually, not long after that, then our instincts and our training kicked in, and we went into investigative mode.
It quickly becomes clear this is different. This will need more experience, more tools, and more expertise than Carroll County has.
And I know that if I put out the call, or even Doug Carter, or, you know, even the FBI were to put out that call, hey, we need, you know, this, this, and this, that someone's going to respond to us, because that's the way our profession works.
Doug Carter. At the start of each chapter of this podcast, you'll hear his voice because he's one of the key people in this case. He's the superintendent of the Indiana State Police, and his part of the story really starts here. He's about to launch a full-scale double murder investigation, and it's clear when you talk to him that this is the case. He will solve it. It's a mission he's hell-bent on finishing.
I just received a phone call that we believe we found the two bodies of the two girls. We didn't know who they were exactly at the time. I immediately left. I immediately left downtown Indianapolis and drove to Delphi, to the crime scene. And we had a significant response there. We had aviation assets on the way. Everything, every kind of specialty that the ISP has to offer to the local community. So we responded with all we had.
Also leaving Indianapolis is Sergeant Kim Riley. He's a state police spokesman, and in a few hours will be giving the first press briefing.
On the way up, I was making calls to some of our investigators, trying to find out what they knew. And basically, most of them hadn't even got to the scene either. When you realize that the state police post is about 30 minutes away from that location, I realized most of them probably were running with lights and siren to get up there as soon as possible, because it was an emergency situation. I mean, it was something that here we got two young girls who had been murdered. We didn't know how. We didn't know why. We didn't have any answers at that point in time.
Anna Williams is Abby's mother. She spent most of the morning at the firehouse waiting for any word about her daughter. And then the word comes.
So Pastor Todd found me and said, well, we need to go upstairs. And before the words came out of his mouth, I knew that this was not a happy thing. I didn't know all the details then as to what was going on, but it definitely wasn't positive. I remember that.
Do you remember his words?
That's kind of blurry. It was, they believe that they have found the girls, and they're not with us. And I remember after that, I was so upset because the last 3 years that she had been at church camp, she kept asking to get baptized. And I said, no, I want you to do it when we're all here together as a family. And that was the first thing I said. I said, never got it done. He's like, Anna, your daughter gave her heart to the Lord, and she is with him today. And you know that. And from that moment on, head to toe, it went whoosh. And I just knew, no matter what, that my girl was okay. And I've stayed with that this is temporary.
More than 200 miles away, Libby's mom, Carrie Timmons, is headed for Delphi when her phone rings.
And my brother called me. And he said, Carrie, I'm seeing some really disturbing things on Facebook. So my brother says, you need to call Becky. And I refused, just flat, no, I'm not calling her. I think now that was like, if I don't call her, it's not true, it's not. So I called Kelsey. I don't know why in my mind that was any different, but I called Kelsey. She didn't answer, and so I kept calling. I probably called her 10 times, no answer. And so I had jumped in the car and I was on my way to the gas station. Fine, if they're not gonna call me, I'm going. I'm on my way. And I was probably 4 or 5 blocks away from the gas station when my phone rang, and it was Kelsey's number that popped up. So I'm expecting when I answer the phone to hear Kelsey say, "Mom, we found her." And it was Derek. And Derek and I hadn't really talked much at that point. So it was kind of a shock for him to be on the phone. And he said, "Carrie, they found the girls." And I had like a split second of, oh, thank God. But he didn't say anything else. And I was like, "Are they okay?" He said, "No." And at that point, I think I was like primal evil just came out of me and screaming, "No." And I said, "Are they alive?" And he said, "No." And I don't know how I made it to the gas station because I was just hysterical. People were staring at me. And I just wanted to disappear. I wanted it to all go away. I'd pulled up on the wrong side of the gas pump. And here I was outside of the pump screaming, and why can't I get the nozzle in the thing, because it wasn't even there.
I remember I was on my lunch break and I was coming back from work, and my boss had stopped me at the door and she was like, "I think you need to go home."
Kelsey and Libby's cousin, Mercedes Moudy, she goes by Sadie, finds out too. She's just a few years older and grew up with the girls.
And I was like, "For what?" And she's like, "Well, the news said," and so I rushed back home. I picked up my cousin, and we went to the fire station. My aunt was just a hot mess. I mean, we all were a hot mess. And then they came in and said that they had found two bodies. They didn't say who they were or what they were, and then that's kind of when the reality sunk in. Like, something bad had happened.
Meanwhile, Becky Patty is in a search party.
A friend of ours was in also one of the search groups that was across the creek, and he saw something. So he took his phone and zoomed in, and it was a tie-dye shirt, and he knew what Libby wore. And his wife, she come back, and she said they found the girls. Well, I was kind of excited, you know, and then it hit me. I said, "Are they okay?" She wouldn't answer. So I knew that they found them. So we hurried up and jumped in our cars and went back to the trailhead. And one of the firemen was there. And I said, you need to take me to Libby now. You need to take me. She's going to need me." They wouldn't let us go close. They wouldn't take me. So that's when he came up. He says, we need to go to the truck." And while we were sitting in the truck, the coroner's van kept driving by. That's when you realize this is real. This isn't a mistake. But they really just hurt. And they couldn't say it was them. But everybody knew it was.
Anna Williams is still at the firehouse.
And I was like, "Well, maybe it's not them." And that lasted like 10 seconds. I'm like, "No, who else would it be? I mean, we knew, I knew." But there was still that 10, 15 seconds where you just hope. And then, you know, my closest friends and coworkers were standing outside, And I walked down there and like, oh, there you are. We were looking for you. And she said, what's going on? I said, they found him. She's like, oh, thank God. And I just shook my head and she was like, oh no. And we just stood there. I mean, we were just in shock. It just didn't make any sense.
The search is over. Fire Chief Daryl Sterrett is dealing with the gravity of telling hundreds of volunteers that they're no longer needed.
Of course, you have to stand like a stone and you have to keep it together while you tell 200 people that we didn't win this one. And I came back inside our little command circle downstairs and I had to go into our utility closet to collect myself. But then again, you're only allowed so much time before you have to come back out and be who you're supposed to be and keep it together. Because if you lose it, then everybody around you is going to lose it. And I waited because I knew my guys would be trickling back in eventually. And I did not want them to decompress in front of the public. And I wanted to keep the public away from them. I didn't know which of my guys had been to the scene, but I knew they had all been out there.
Was it one of your guys that found the scene?
I was told that it was a private citizen. That's all I was told. But I know now, after the fact, that a couple of my guys had been there shortly after the discovery. And that's why I wanted to be here when they came back, because I know what they do when they're stressed out. And I did not want that to happen with as much public as we had here. And I wanted to keep them separate from the public. And the public, they mean no disrespect, they mean no harm. They don't understand what these guys actually face. And if you touch that nerve, that happens. So a couple of my guys were trickling in, and one of my most loyal, hardened, that guy came in, and I put myself between him and the crowd, and he kind of started talking. I said, just go to the other side of the engine, go to the other side of the engine. And we went over to the other side of the engine, which I had roped off just for them. And he started taking the boots off and stuff, and I just said, I don't even remember what the comment was, but it alluded to the fact that it was not a good end. He didn't know, and it's hard to see a guy that tough and that strong break down and just lose it. But these guys are all heart.
Barb, we're back here in the writer's room at CNN Center. And, you know, thinking about where we are in the story, there's a couple conversations we had that I remember distinctly. And one of those was with Mike Patty. In the garage of his home, we sat there and had a good two-hour interview with him. And I remember asking him about when they found out that the girls had been found. What was their next move? Did they go to church? Did they go home? He had to think about it for a second, and he couldn't really remember. And he said something to the effect of how, I don't know, we just, you know, I don't really know. And so it really is kind of a microcosm of where we are here for the families, because it's a really blurry moment.
And it's going to stay blurry for them for a little while, but the group that needs really laser-sharp focus right now is the investigators, because they are jumping right in, both feet into this double murder homicide investigation.
There's a killer on the loose. They gotta find this guy. The clock's ticking.
Part two. 300 feet away.
at one point where the state police had taken over our fire station. We could barely get trucks out if we needed to, and we had conversations, and we got that figured out, and I think they ended up with a pretty good infrastructure to be able to conduct the investigation.
Drew, you mentioned the clock is ticking. First 48 hours are significant in any murder investigation.
Any law enforcement agency will tell you that if they're going to make an arrest, the first 48 hours is the most pivotal time.
And so, yeah, the clock is ticking. They are jumping into this. And they're trying to make sense of this crime scene that they know where the girls were found on private property. They don't know at this point, they're going to learn soon enough, that that crime scene stretches about a quarter of a mile back to the bridge. So they're dealing with a very, very large area here that they have to start going through with a fine-tooth comb, essentially.
Leaves, hills, water. Yeah, this is not an easy crime scene to manage. And so the other thing to note is that logistically, getting out there with the resources that are required isn't easy either. And so, you know, one of the folks with the ISP that we spoke with was even talking about, from a logistical standpoint, the cell towers in the area couldn't really handle the bandwidth of cell phones, police scanners, communication equipment. So they had to bring in mobile command centers just to handle that infrastructure. And so the crime scene's complex. The logistics are complex. It's rural Indiana. So there's a lot of hurdles they have to clear here.
And that's what's going on when the superintendent of state police gets on scene.
I saw fear in people's eyes, not even anger at that point, because again, we didn't confirm that it was Abby and Libby. Pretty obvious, though. I think most people knew that it was. Horror. The things that I'm thinking in my mind is, how do we sustain this? What assets do we need that aren't here? Once they're here, how do we keep them? And then the logistics behind that, just how my mind thinks. I had an immediate conversation with my boss, the governor of the state of Indiana, Eric Holcomb, and I knew he would say what he did. But anything that community needs, the answer is, of course, yes. The law enforcement response, the local law enforcement response, I knew that since it's a very rural area, that it was going to require a tremendous response from state police. I know what their limitations are, and it's nothing against them. They do the best they can, and they've done a really nice job. But they have two detectives in the whole county, so we jumped in.
One of those men jumping in is Public Information Officer Sergeant Kim Riley. Sergeant Riley knows this area. He'd patrolled it earlier in his career. His first hurdle is trying to understand the scope of the crime scene and his first impressions.
I saw a lot of people that with blank looks on their face, people that are just wondering, why did this happen, or who would do such a thing as this? When I was talking to the officers that had got to the scene and I was trying to get some information, they were looking the same way. The way the girls were found, how they were found, what had happened to them. It was just a lot of things were going through their minds and just trying to get to figure out the crime scene. You know, is it here? Is it there? How much of a crime scene do we have here? And that was one of the questions that was being discussed too. You know, how big of a crime scene have we got? What are we dealing with? How much evidence have we got here to deal with? Those are things that were going through the minds. I know the investigators, the crime scene technicians had already arrived, so they were starting to look at the crime scene to see what they could do.
So once the girls were found, you said a couple hundred people had been out there looking for them. So the girls are found, you begin to secure off that area. What is that process like, and how do you get those people out of there?
Well, actually, we don't want to get them too far out because we want to make sure and keep them close by, because first of all, we have to interview them to see what they found, what they did at the scene, get any pertinent information from them that we can get, their name, address, phone number, so we can get, you know, later on in the investigation, if we need more information or if we need, you know, whatever from them, we can get a hold of them and get that information. They basically all gave us a statement which is just basically protocol on any type of a crime scene that somebody would walk up on. And that's basically what we did with the people that were there. And then we just try to figure out at that point in time, how big is this crime scene going to be? I mean, if you've never been there, you got to remember we're in Indiana, we're in central Indiana, and the ravines are not deep here, but we do have ravines, small hills. And there was basically a creek that ran through there, right, real close to the crime scene. It was down in the lower gully, I guess you'd call it, where the bodies were found. There was two hills on each side and plus one on the other side of the creek. So, you know, trying to figure out where did they come from, how did they get here, which way did the suspect or suspects go. Those are all things that they're trying to figure out to see how large of a crime scene they got to make.
And the crime scene begins on the bridge?
Well, the crime scene originally started where we found the bodies, because that was all the crime scene we knew at that point in time. As we found evidence and looked into things, found the phone, that's when we've realized that the crime scene actually did start at the bridge. So now we have to back up even more to bring that bridge into the crime scene. So now we've got it. We're moving from the crime scene from maybe a third of an acre. Now we're talking, because it's walking, it's about a quarter of a mile from where the bodies were found to where the video was taken. And so trying to figure out, okay, where did they walk? And you got to remember, you had 400 or 500 people that started looking for these girls the night before. So you know, we had to deal with that because
so
we know
a lot
people,
of tracks.
Right,
out there.
A lot of tracks, cigarette butts. Believe it or not, this kind of disgusting, but you had spit. People would urinate. I mean, because they don't have time to go back, so they go hide in the woods to go to the bathroom, that kind of stuff. So we had to deal with all that. And most people don't even think of things like that. But, you know, when you're trying to process a crime scene, you got to remember it's the spring of the year, or well, late winter in February. You got all the leaves on the ground. We basically had to turn every leaf over from the crime scene all the way up the whole thing. And I don't mean we turn every one, but I mean it was just that dramatic of a crime scene. That's what took so long.
That's a time when thoughtful reason must kick in, not emotion, because we know we have one time to do this right.
Superintendent Doug Carter.
That was a bit of a challenge to try and calm air, take a step back from this. We brought in, I think, 5, maybe 6 crime scene technicians. And our job at that point was to build a fence around this, not a literal one, one figuratively, and do everything that we needed to support them. The crime scene was very complicated.
Compared to other investigations you do, where does it?
Well, I think it's be commonly known that it includes the Monon High Bridge. It includes the trailhead. We've been there. It's a cool little bench there to sit on and reflect if you haven't
Absolutely.
Done that.
Absolutely. We just did it the other day.
Yeah, you spend some time there too. It's nice, isn't it? Very reflective. So everywhere from the trailhead on. That's all I can say about the crime scene.
So we kind of got a break, I guess you'd say. We didn't have to deal with a snowstorm. We didn't have to deal with it didn't rain. So we were able to process that and get it done as quickly as we could. But it still took a long time to do.
Are you confident that you recovered everything that could have been recovered there?
I believe we done the best we could do. I'm not going to say we didn't miss anything. I mean, we're human beings. We're going to miss things. But overall, I mean, the way they did it, one guy would check over somebody else's work to see if there was anything they felt that they missed. And so it was, I mean, it wasn't just one crime scene technician doing this. Our people were there. We had other departments that had people there. It was a joint effort in collecting this. And then there was people that came in after that just to make sure we covered everything. They started at sunrise and didn't quit till way past 9-10 o'clock. So it wasn't like they weren't there. And then we had guards or other troopers and sheriff's departments that helped secure the scenes when they were gone so that we didn't have somebody walking in and, you know, trying to get pictures or do something. I mean, it was well secured.
And you said this was an area you had patrolled as a trooper earlier in your career. You're familiar mm-hmm. with the area. You know some of these people. You're a father and a grandfather in addition to being a cop. What is going through your head as you're out there?
Well, I didn't go up to the crime scene. There was one ridge you could actually go to And I stood on that ridge, and I could see the crime scene. It was still probably 200 to 300 feet away from me. I could see the crime scene, but I didn't feel comfortable. First of all, I didn't want to go to the crime scene. I didn't want to be somebody that would contaminate something. And that's one of the things why we keep people out. But just looking at those two young girls laying there on the ground, it brought memories of my daughters when they were that age. And how I would feel if I was their father. It was very emotional for me. And like I said, I didn't know their parents at that time, but I knew a lot of people in Delphi and a lot of people that were in the search party. I knew a lot of those people. But, you know, it'd been, like I said, it'd probably been 15, 20 years since I've been there. So it was kind of a, I don't want to use the word reunion, but it was a time where they would interact with me and I was interacting with them to just to try to get their feelings of what their feelings were and what I was going through. And I was from a small town also. So knowing how a small town works in central United States made a big difference on how I reacted and how I was feeling what could feel their pain, but didn't know their pain, if that makes sense. And that was tough knowing that. Basically, we're going to make this, it's going to be short and sweet. We don't have that much at this point in time. Basically, what we've got, we have found two bodies in Deer Creek, about a mile east of town. We are investigating this as a crime scene. We suspect foul play. We have not made positive identification of the two bodies, so we're not going to be releasing any information on them at this point in time. We've got the Indiana State Police is assisting the Carroll County Sheriff's Department and the Delphi City Police Department in the investigation here. We also have the FBI Crime Scene Investigation Group here out of Indianapolis. And one thing the family asked us to do is to thank all the communities around Delphi and the people here in Delphi for assisting in attempting to locate these the two young children that were missing earlier. They just wanted to say thank you to those people. And thank you. They were just wanted to express their gratitude toward the hard work that was done in helping search for these children.
Sergeant Kim Riley doesn't say the girls' names in that press conference, but everyone knows. And as the announcement makes its way across town, Abby and Libby's friends and teachers are in class. They're about to find out. Pastor Todd Ladd is learning his services are needed there, too.
I received a phone call from the school corporation asking for me to have my staff come over and help with the school. I responded.
The school was in session on Tuesday.
School's in session.
Monday they had been out when the girls went missing, but on Tuesday it was a normal day with school.
Yes. However, on that day, I responded and said, I can't be there. I'm with families right now, but I'll send my staff over. Interestingly enough, my staff had already gone over. They'd already gathered at the middle school library. And interestingly enough, because we're a small, close-knit town, many other counselors were already there. Many other pastors were already there at the school to be able to talk with kids and encourage them. So that was the next step to make sure that piece was covered. The other piece was a bit of care for the media as well. At that point in time, where do we have a press conference? What do we do? So we talked about having that downstairs in the city building, helping share with the media, here's where you'll set up, here's where the police will set, and it's just kind of things are happening all at once.
Erica Gibson, you'll remember, is good friends with both Abby and Libby. And if you saw Erica and Libby together, you'd swear they were twins. On the afternoon of the 14th, she's sitting in class waiting for news.
Who pulled you out of class?
Our counselor pulled us out of class to tell us that they found them.
And what did the counselor say to you?
She didn't say anything. She pulled us out. We were in health class, 6 hour. She pulled us out and we walked into the office and my dad's standing there, like, cause he was in the search party. He was standing there in his clothes and then her mom was in her scrubs and we just knew. Like they didn't even have to say anything. Like we just knew. And so then they took us to the principal's office to like calm us down.
And what did that feel like for you?
Heartbroken. It was terrible. It something I never wish on anybody at all. Especially, like, afterwards we went into the library and a bunch of the kids in our grade were there and they were just sobbing and we were having a circle talking to, like, pastors and stuff like that already. And, like, some of the kids, boys I've never seen show any emotion. They were distraught and it was really sad, really bad.
How were the adults? Did they seem as heartbroken as you?
Yes. One of my favorite teachers came in a little bit after. After students got called out of her class and stuff, she actually asked if someone could watch her class so she could be in the library with us because she was our eighth grade teacher at that, and Libby's. But she was the math bowl coach too. So she was also close to her in that way. And she just came in and we just all sat and hugged her. And I mean, it was terrible the next few days, really bad. We had dogs come in and that was nice. And
you mean like comfort animals, right?
Yes. We had the support at the school. We really did.
No one had specifically told me. I just kind of figured it out based on clues around the hallway when kids were crying.
Cynthia Rossi is also a friend of Abby and Libby. We met her in the last chapter. And when you talk to her today, it's clear she had to grow up quickly. And this is where it starts.
They had started taking kids in, putting them into the library, and they had counselors there. And I knew when I saw, like, all the different visitor passes and, like, people crying and school officials walking around all over the place, I knew that it probably hadn't ended well.
And did you ask anybody what was happening or what happened next for you?
I didn't ask anybody because I just kind of had this feeling. And then I went into the library with my friends and we just talked with some of our teachers about them.
And were there pastors there at that point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's going through your mind, finding out that your friends are missing, now they've been found, and it's not good?
I think it was just, I am the type of person where I want to be there for other people. So I was just mostly, like, consoling my friends and making sure that they were okay. And I kind of regret that because it's like the analogy that if you keep, like, if you have a cup full of water and you just keep pouring to other people, you don't have any left for yourself. So I was so worried about other people, and I wish I would have taken that time to, you know, sit down and ask myself, are you okay? Are you ready to deal with this? Rather than just talking to people. Like, that whole night, I stayed up and talked to friends and their family members and my family members, where I wish that I would just let myself deal with it and just take some time away from my phone, away from social media, away from everyone, and just decompress and let myself deal with it.
And I said, listen, you're babies and you don't know how to deal with this because I don't know how to deal with this.
That's Christine Lang. She's one of Abby and Libby's teachers, and she's dealt with a lot of things in her classroom, but never this.
I said, absolutely no one. You don't have a class in college that talks about what you do when a student passes away from any reason. And you and I both know it's just out of order. We shouldn't bury our babies or our grandbabies. And so everyone was just trying to love each other.
The text that you got that they had been found, was that, did you get the notification that they had passed from something so horrific, or was it they've been found and they passed away?
It was just, she was not out there. I think a family member of hers was helping, and no. And I will say, I don't think we really knew, nor do we know all the details, and I don't want to, and that's not my business. But then I think by the time people were gathering in the library, that it had come to be known that there was some wrongdoing. I don't know that the kids or even I was aware that day of how horrible it was.
It is hearing these kids and these teachers talk about learning of Abby and Libby's death. I am reminded that there is a very big difference between you know, them learning that they're dead and learning that it was murder and what goes with that.
And how shocking that must be that two of your friends disappear and now they're dead. And even though we haven't heard the police officially say that this is Abby and Libby that have been found, everybody knows that. Everybody's operating at this point as if it is Abby and Libby.
Why don't you think they announced them officially early on?
I'm not entirely sure. I think, though, that they realize they're dealing with something different here, and they're going by the book. The bodies need to be taken to Terre Haute for the autopsy, and that's usually when the official ID process right. comes about.
Well, and while that ID still needs to be made, the investigation is kind of kicking off here with multiple jurisdictions and agencies, because Carroll County and the sheriff's office there will probably be the first to tell you we don't necessarily have the resources or the experience to handle.
Or the budget.
Or the budget to handle something like that.
Exactly. And Indiana State Police have access to so many more resources around the state and even outside of the state. They have the governor's office on board. And so we'll see that sort of change of hands with this investigation. And I think that having all of those agencies there that early is also symbolic of we're dealing with something different here. This is not a routine case that's being investigated.
Something entirely different that the town is also learning and trying to determine how long before they take their first step forward.
Hey everyone, it's Dan. While we were in Delphi, we spoke to a lot of people and had many amazing conversations. So many, in fact, that we weren't able to fit them all in the show. One thing that we feel very strongly about, though, is including a picture of who Libby German and Abby Williams were. They're the victims of this horrible crime, yes, but we don't think that's what should define them. What should are the details of what made them incredible people. In the last chapter, we learned a little bit about Abby from her mom, Anna Williams. This chapter, we'll meet Libby. Here's her mom, Carrie Timmons.
She was just the sunshine in your day, you know. Always wanted everybody to laugh. Never wanted anyone to feel bad about themselves. So she would always, like, she's always complimenting someone. But at the same time, we could sit back and tease and joke and make fun. People watch, and she was just your typical all-around good kid. Fun to be around. Always on the go, always wanted to help someone or do something. You know, what can we do to make you happy today? Kind of person, always joking. And strangely, even though she was my 14-year-old daughter, she would be who I would go to for advice a lot of times. Wise beyond her years. I was going through a divorce at the time, leading up to the February 2017. And she would call me just to check up on me and make sure I would, you know, how are you doing today, Mom? And if I would talk to her about what was going on, she always just had the wisest things to say. And I'm like, how do you even, like, you've never even been in a relationship. How do you know so much? And she would say, sometimes when I'm in my room, I just think about what my life will be like when I'm older. What if my husband came home one day and he was mad at me, how I would fix the situation? And I'm glad she was able to do that because obviously she's not going to get that chance to grow up and be in those relationships. But it was almost like she already knew. Like she knew what life was supposed to be like and she was happy.
We'll have some more special moments in the next chapter. For now, though, let's get back to the show.
Part 3, Allowed to be Angry.
I don't know if anybody knew what to do, and if there is anything that you could do, that would be perfect. Do you have an instance that hasn't happened in the city of Delphi? We've had murders, but nothing like this. And then to have one that attracts not only local coverage, which would be expected, but to have national and international coverage is something that we weren't prepared for, and I don't know if anybody's prepared for.
Barb, there's a period after these crimes that, after the initial shock, which can last a long time, obviously, but after the initial shock of learning what happened and accepting what's happening, the families have to process this and have to begin to think about moving ahead logistically, things like that, planning funerals. But there is a processing period that goes on.
And we're about to hear some of the sort of stumbles with that in the early hours of that process for these families. And there's a lot of activity still going on here. We have all of the law enforcement in place to begin this investigation. And we also have media from all over the state of Indiana and outside of the state
right
now taking an interest in this and starting to call Kim Riley and get to the area themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't take long for media to learn what happened and latch onto the story. I mean, it grows like wildfire.
Yes, absolutely. And also at the school, the kids now know what happened, that Abby and Libby have been found, but they don't know anything beyond that. And that's going to be difficult conversation for a lot of them.
And you know what else is interesting is that obviously this investigation is ratcheting up. I mean, it's going to ratchet up kind of almost infinitely, it seems like, but it's going to ratchet up. And then while that's going on and while the kids in the school have to, you know, we talked about processing, while these kids have to process what's happened, there's also a whole other element of the fear that, wait a second, the guy that did this is walking around.
Could still be here.
May very well still be in Delphi. And so, you know, for people like Erica Gibson and Cynthia Rossi, their friends have been killed, but they are also dealing with the fact that the town that they know as kind of this small little innocent town outside of Indianapolis,
where nothing really big happens.
Well, that's not the case anymore.
Not anymore.
So you have these young kids who aren't really aware of how this happened. And you have parents who have to figure out a way to kind of have this moment with their kids to explain what happened. And additionally, you've got teachers at the schools who are trying to figure out, how do we address this in class? And Christine Lang had to figure that out too.
And, you know, I think teachers, all of us, you know, plans change in a minute. A kid gets sick, a kid makes a mistake, a kid throws up in your room, a kid has a seizure, and, you know, all those things you just adjust to. And we had a student at the high school. I think he was sick at that time, and he has since passed away from cancer. And, you know, you at least had some time, some thoughts that maybe this would happen. So, no, you're absolutely right. You get this news, and you as adults and moms and dads and brothers in the building, you just go into action for the kids that are in your care. I mean, you tried very hard not to break in front of them and, you know, at home, but I'm not going to pretend for the next few days, few months, really, till May when we talked about them, you know, we had tears in our room, and I think that's okay. But I don't, I mean, you knew the day before that they were missing, and you think of all the scenarios, and I think, you know, you thought maybe they fell, maybe they got lost. I don't think you think in Delphi that someone took your babies and this is what happened. So I don't think anyone had any time to prepare. I think it was just, this is what we do for a living. And so now you just love them different today.
Amy Brown is Erica's mom. And like a lot of moms in town, she's on the way to pick up her daughter, figuring out how to tell her this wasn't an accident. It was on purpose.
You're talking about telling her in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you had talked to her dad, and he had kind of given you some news. So you essentially had like 45 minutes to figure out how to, you know, pull the rug out from under your daughter's life. And I'm curious, you know, your drive to pick her up, I can't imagine what you were thinking. Like, how do I tell? Like, can you take us through, like, from your perspective, how do I tell her this? What are the words I use? What's
That's essentially exactly what I did, as I'm like literally bawling, driving there, you know, like, and I can remember talking to myself, like saying out loud, what are you going to do? How are you going to tell her this? You know, and for a while I thought, I'm just not going to tell her. Like, we'll pretend we saw it on TV, you know, or something. But then I was like, you know, I rationalized in my head, no, she deserves to know what happened, you know? And so it was just like a whole internal conflict on how to tell her. And I finally just thought, I'm just going to tell her. Like, I'm not going to use fancy words. I'm not going to say anything. You know, I'm just going to tell her somebody did this.
And you had to know that the words coming out of your mouth were going to change her life forever.
Absolutely. I just kept thinking her life will never be the same. This one instance is going to dictate the rest of her life. You know? And so depending on, you know, how she would react to it. And knowing her as well as I did, I knew that it would.
My husband and I went back to our house, and I had forgotten that everybody's there.
Cynthia's mom, Denise, is trying to figure out the same thing as she heads home. Her backyard has become a staging area for law enforcement because she lives so close to the crime scene.
So there's search teams all around, all in our house. And then all these people are asking us questions, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. I remember that. And then we got in the house, and I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't breathe. And I was thinking about experiences I had had with loss and what to say. And I kept thinking as a mom, they're allowed to be sad. They're allowed to be angry. They're allowed to be mad. Don't stifle anything they're feeling. I remember just all these weird things going through my head that you'd never think.
I think right after I had gotten out of school, they had announced that they were suspecting foul play. And I had no clue what that meant because, I mean, I was only 12, 13 years old. And then I asked my mom what that meant, and she said it means that it was probably a homicide and somebody else did this to them. It wasn't an accident. It was planned, and it was an attack.
And what did you think about that?
I just couldn't stop thinking about why someone would target two of the most innocent people I'd ever met, why it had to happen to me, why Delphi, it's just this small town in the middle of nowhere, and you blink and you're already past it. How could something so horrific and terrifying found its way here?
Becky Patty and her husband Mike are heading home to wait for the rest of their family without Libby.
At that point in time, I wasn't thinking how it happened, just that she was gone. I guess your mind doesn't go past that for a while. You don't even think to ask questions for just a little bit. You just know that she's not here. But I think it was shortly after that. I think it was that day even that they did come out and say that they suspected foul play. Mm-hmm. So that's when it starts hitting. Oh my gosh, they were killed. They were killed. You know, you have to let that one sink in a little bit. Because it's one thing if they fall, but it's another thing that, oh, this isn't right.
Like I said, it's a little blurry to me because we're still in a state of disbelief, you know, that this is, this can't be happening. This is, I mean, come on, guys, this is not happening. Not here, not now, not to us. So, yeah, obviously, you know, law enforcement, the police, they did what they were supposed to do. You know what I mean? You know, they're trying to gather and collect as much information so they can get on top of this as quick as they can. Yeah, I do remember, you know, going in and talking to the police. We're just kind of putting one foot in front of the other, and, you know, somebody hollers or calls, and then we go here, we go there. You know, Becky put it very well. It was almost like a out-of-body kind of experience. You know, you're watching everything go on, and you're like, man, I'm not even a part of this. You know, it's it's happening and what's going on, and somebody explain this, you know. But it was, you know, very difficult. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. There's no words to that I can think of anyway to explain. It's a bad time.
Libby's cousin Sadie, we heard from her earlier in this chapter, remembers one particular moment.
We were all just sitting around the table. It was quiet. And then you could tell that nobody wanted to say anything. Like, there was just, like, the heavy aroma in the house. And we were sitting there, and my Aunt Becky had yelled upstairs for Libby to call her mom and tell her what happened. And then she hollered out, like, three or four times, and all of our eyes just got, like, really big. Like, what do we say? Like, what do we do? And then she finally realized, and she buried her face in her hands and ran to the bedroom. And then we were all like, well, I think we should leave them alone now. So.
While the families are trying to process what's happening, Pastor Todd suddenly has a bigger congregation. He's ministering not just to a church, but an entire town.
You had already been working here 16, 17 years when this happened. What does that sort of atmosphere of the town feel like as you're going about Tuesday, making plans for a press conference and a prayer vigil after this horrific thing has happened in your city? What does the town feel like?
Frankly, it was hard to get a feel for the town. I was so zoned in on what needed to be done at that moment. So really, I'm not getting a sense for the town's feeling until they come to the prayer vigil. I didn't know if we'd have 50 people here. Didn't know if we'd have 100 people here. I just didn't know what it was. What gave me a clue of what's going to happen was when my secretary began to report the Facebook responses and the shares. She would say it's been shared 100 times, 250 times, 500 times, 1,000 times, 1,500 times. And she quit when it had done been sharing 2,500 times. And I
That's
said, please
big
stop.
Big for a town of 3,000 people.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So at that point in time, okay, you begin to get a sense of what it's going to be like. And the place was filled and into the rotunda. And the nice thing was this. I made two phone calls, one to a staff person, one to a volunteer, and said, we need hospitality. And immediately I had 40 people who are ready to serve their community. That's part of who Delphi is. When you ask one question and people respond like that, you know you're not in it alone. And that's when it's good.
That makes you emotional.
It certainly does. Absolutely. Because you don't do this job alone. The temptation is to do it alone. But you cannot do it alone. And so the more you have people around you, the better off you are. And I watched this church serve, and many churches serve amazingly through this entire time. You look at things like the motorcycle ride. You look at things like the walk to reclaim the trails. You look at the Abby Libby celebration of life. That's coming from the entire community. That's the fabric of this community. That's so important.
Mayor Shane Evans, for the first time, realizes February 14th and what it means will always be different.
That was actually the first Valentine's Day I'd spent with the woman who's now my wife. And so she came into the office. We had plans to go on a date or something that night, and she came into the office, and I remember hugging her and bawling. It was the first time that day I really got to express my emotions. You know, you're out in the public, you're dealing, and it's not trying to stay strong for everybody, but there's a lot to be done that day. And really, that was the first time I broke down. And that's another vivid memory that I have, but I think it shows me how much she means to me. To be able to break down in front of somebody like that and to cry and to have them be your support. And she was dealing with the same emotions that I was. This is all of our communities. This community belongs to all of us. And so we were all feeling the same emotions. But for her to, I guess, be the stronger one for me at that moment means a lot.
While Delphi is gathering at the Methodist Church, Chief Daryl Sterrett is back at the firehouse, and he's worried about his men.
That night, early afternoon, whatever, I told the guys, I said, just go home, be with your families, decompress a little bit, come back tonight, we'll have beer and pizza, don't take this home. And we had a few guys come back, and it isn't about talking about what you've seen or where you've been, it's just sometimes it's too early to go to those quiet moments. I think there's a point where it's too early to bring in the professionals to talk about it. I'm not saying you can heal it yourself, but the first thing, you know, I feel I would lose so much respect if my guys had come in and there was some doctor standing there that they didn't know. We needed to be together, and that's what we did.
Like a family.
Yes. And the guys, you know, I'm good, we're fine. You know, thanks for the beer, pizza, you know. We talked and chatted it out. Probably didn't talk about the scene one time. Maybe a question of this or a question of that. And I felt that was good. If they wanted to talk about it, that's why we were there. If you don't want to talk about it, I know better than to try to make you. I knew there would be a time when we would have the professional that day, that evening was not it. So we did that, went home, and late evening, 10:30, 11 o'clock, I get a phone call from, I think, Chief Mullins, wanting to know if we can send some equipment out to the scene to assist with the state police and FBI or whoever. There's so many people here at that point,
right,
to assist with the scene investigation. After standing on concrete for 2 days straight, I couldn't even get off of the couch. My back was done. I made phone calls to a couple. You can't just send anybody. You had to send the right people because you didn't want to send them into the scene. And I thought I expressed that with Chief Mullins. And I sent three or four of my guys to take care of it. I felt horrible. I couldn't do it myself, but I physically could not walk. And so they went that evening and assisted with the crime scene. I think they were there till mid-morning. I don't know.
As the day ends, the man tasked with finding a killer is getting in his car.
You're out there for several hours. What did you do next?
Drove. Took the long way home. I've got my wife is just awesome. She's incredibly supportive and understanding. And I knew this one was going to be different. And I called her and said, three cups of coffee home, probably. Just going to go take the long way. So I did. I just drove by myself for a while.
Did you listen to music?
Nope. Total silence. I've often thought about that silence, actually, because it's normally it's not like that. At the time, I wondered if I need to still do what I do. Yeah.
Do you still ask yourself that?
Nope. Not up to me anymore. No.
The town of Delphi will forever be measured in two parts, before and after February 14th, 2017. What they'll soon see is cop cars on every corner, media trucks on Main Street, and fear and suspicion in the eyes of friends and neighbors. Friends and neighbors who know there may be a killer in town. And tomorrow, they'll see him.
Down the Hill, The Delphi Murders, is written and produced by Andrew Iden, Barbara McDonald, and me, Dan Semitovich, with original music and scoring by Shuvo Sir, and production support from associate producers Michael Dudley and Kayleen Chassie. If you want to see the people, places, and things we're talking about, visit our website, downthehillpodcast.com. Brian Bell is HLN's Senior Director of Programming, and Tyler Moody is the Vice President of the Warner Media Podcast Network. Sherry Seldes is our Senior Production Manager. A lot of folks at HLN and CNN worked hard to help make this show go, and we want to give a big thank you to them. Also, a special thanks to the people of Delphi and the members of law enforcement who are in charge of solving this crime. Most of all, thank you. We really appreciate you listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.